Our next speaker is John Elwood from the Eden Institute for the Environment from William Carey International University. And he's going to be speaking on eco-realism, hope and hopelessness in an injured ecosystem.
Well, good morning. Wow, it's intimidating to follow Sam, like a real scientist. And you're not going to be hearing from a scientist with me. I'm a theologian. And I have I'm now well into my third decade of climate activism. I think that I have for 20 minutes I should have I think like an hour and 10 minutes if I look at this clock. So I'm just going to revise my notes a little bit and You can take comfort that I am right now setting my timer for 20 minutes. A special word of thanks before I begin to my colleague Lowell Bliss, who yesterday offered a critical review of the state of the creation care movement. Also to my new friend, John Wood, who noted the refusal or failure of much of the Christian tradition to look death in the face. And to my fellow Union Seminary alum, David Larrabee, who a couple of days ago confronted us with the intractable nature of what we have done to the climate. Don't worry, gentlemen, I'm not borrowing you as allies for what I'm about to say, but I think that you are guided by some of the same impulses that have led to my work. And I'd be remiss in also not thanking Janelle Curry. Janelle, can I call you an old friend? Will that work? Yes, for inviting a first-timer. You know, we wear the pink here. But thanks to you all also for dedicating an hour to, a period, not an hour, of time to look into something that is really difficult. And that is this question. In light of the current runaway ecological crisis and pervasive resistance from powerful actors, is it possibly already too late for most of the solutions that we have been advocating? And what is at stake in how we answer this question? In 1972, the pioneering eco-theologian John Cobb told the story of a passenger liner putting out to sea on a long voyage. The ship had luxury accommodations for the rich, but below deck are the steerage quarters, crowded, uncomfortable, with poor food and a variety of illnesses. And far out at sea, struggle breaks out in John's story between these unequal classes, and it leads to violence and even death. Amidst the din, few pay much heed to news that the ship has sprung a leak that worsens with time and neglect. Cobb's parable posed a question: can humanity locked in conflict pull together soon enough for the final defense of our common home? Of course, the assumption behind the story was that while the potential for catastrophe is great and time is short, no, it is not too late. If certain actions are taken promptly. Crucially, Cobb's parable ends with a ship merely listing to starboard. Catastrophe remains in the distance. There is still time. No, it is not too late. Today, environmental messaging tends to echo Cobb's formula. Too late is always just around the corner, never actually here. But the crucial fact of our time is that for much of earthly life, this is no longer a given, nor even probable. For this discussion, however, I'd like to posit something less nuanced than that. And that is this: for much of humanity and the interconnected web of planetary life, it is now, in fact, too late for life as remembered in the Holocene, the only epoch that human civilization has ever known. And this is what I mean when I use the term eco-realism. Now, I recognize that this proposition is both controversial and potentially perilous. And yet it's necessary to consider the perils inherent in the blindly optimistic assertions that there is still time to mitigate what we call the worst impacts of climate change, as well as the positive reasons for coming to terms with the inevitable consequences of the damage we have already done and continue to do. So in this discussion, I would like to consider, first, why would one advocate for a perspective that begins with the assertion that crisis is inevitable? And secondly, what challenges does inevitable crisis pose to the prevalent streams of Christianity today? Now, starting with the first of these, I'm going to suggest two responses. And first, I'm going to say that the evidence overwhelmingly demands an eco-realist perspective. And secondly, acknowledging the inevitability of what lies ahead permits us to redirect our focus from what we almost certainly cannot solve toward what we now must solve. Of course, some very respective minds would beg to differ with what I call inevitable, and a few deserve specific mention. We start with Michael Mann, one of the world's leading climate researchers. In 2011, he issued a warning: unless global CO2 emissions were topped out by 2020 and reduced by 80% by mid-century, devastating and irreparable harm would occur, would be locked in for humanity and the biosphere, At least 2 degrees Celsius of warming would then be unavoidable, resulting in chaos, extremes of flooding and drought, mass human migration, persistent famine, and worse, all suffered by the world's poor and disadvantaged. Unimaginable suffering, but not yet too late to address it. A couple of years before Mann, James Hansen published a study that gave birth to the 350 movement, asserting that if we hope to preserve a planet similar to the one on which civilization developed, atmospheric CO2 would need to be reduced from its then current 385 parts per million to at most 350 parts per million. At 385, another 2 degrees Celsius of warming was baked into the atmosphere, even without any further emissions. But Hansen had solutions: a quick phase out of coal and a rising price on carbon emissions, among several other necessary responses. If all were done quickly, keeping CO2 concentrations below 400 parts per million, disaster might be averted. It was still not too late. Hansen and Mann are joined by a host of other experts in this messaging. So, what's the problem with all this? Well, to begin with, the preconditions for optimism are never satisfied. Consider Mann's 2011 report. Emissions did not top out in 2020 as required. Through the current year, they've kept on rising. They're projected to hit an all-time high in 2023, quote, with no clear peak in sight, says the International Energy Agency. Mann's 80% reduction by 2050, the IEA now foresees a 23% increase in annual carbon emissions by mid-century. For Hansen, the catastrophic carbon concentrations of 2008 have now grown to nearly 424 parts per million, and they increase by 2 to 3 points like clockwork every single year. A phase out of coal power plants, carbon removal technologies, a carbon tax, none of these necessary conditions is anywhere near to reality at scale, and their respective deadlines have long since run out. These are alarming, of course, but more recent data leaves even less room for doubt about what lies ahead. No member of the G20 has implemented policies consistent with the Paris Agreement. The world's governments are collectively planning to produce 45% more fossil fuels than levels consistent with 2 degrees of warming by the end of this century. And the G20 countries still direct more in public finance for fossil fuels than for clean energy. The consequences of these failures are now embedded in our future. So, why this pitiful record of failure by the nations of the world? We are all primed to think about our own carbon footprints and our national policies, or lack of policies, of course. But less attention is paid to our institutions, our economic systems, our national and international governance institutions, and our religious and cultural institutions and traditions. In the words of sociobiologist E.O. Wilson, the real problem with humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. It is terrifically dangerous, and it is now approaching a point of crisis overall. The assessment of global economic and governance institutions are beyond the scope of my presentation. But if we can't really stave off ecological crisis, what must religious institutions and persons focus on? Briefly, I would suggest this. First, lesser climate upheavals have occurred throughout human history, and they always lead to social disruption and violence. We must prepare ourselves to respond redemptively to the impulses of what I will call barbarism. Secondly, mass migration is now baked into the future of humanity. The historical record again points to the powerful impulse toward brutality in such times. If the early instances of climate migration in Darfur, in Syria, and Central America are not already persuasive enough. And thirdly, in such times, religious institutions often tend to inflame conflict, both with other religions and within disparate strains of their own traditions. Christianity has never been immune to these impulses, and we already appear to be vulnerable to them in the current crisis. How must we respond? Well, first, we must come to terms, I believe, with our own realities. Of all religious groupings, we have been amongst the most hostile to environmental and climate action. Why Christians? Well, many will start with the low-hanging fruit. We are merely passing through. The world is not our home. It has no eternal significance. Did I just drop this? I did. Here we go. Don't flail your arms when you speak here, or else you might not be heard. Yes. So these arguments lead down a well-trodden path, don't they? Christians have been an easy mark for propaganda, we say, because of failures to understand our own scriptures. We've been raised on bad stories, we say. And we need new creation-focused stories to go along with popular orthodoxy. If the diagnosis is adequate, the answers are right here within the boundaries of evangelical hermeneutics. And yet, the Creation Care campaign to update our stories, in effect, to ignite environmental engagement without changing anything foundational in popular Christian theology, has met with widespread failure. We have not moved the needle. Self-identified Christians are generally AWOL or outright hostile in the struggle to preserve a livable ecosystem. Is it possible that the diagnosis is incomplete? The agricultural philosopher Wes Jackson would say yes. For Jackson, life is the scramble for energy-rich carbon. And for almost all the history of our species, we obtain most of our carbon the way all other animals did, eating plants and other animals. But the last 10,000 years of our history has been different. We learned to tap ever-increasing carbon resources through cultivating carbon-rich soils, and then burning forest fuels, and very recently burning enormous amounts of coal, oil, and finally gas. And with it, we have overwhelmed every hurdle that would limit our dominance as a species. As such, human nature, says Jackson, must now be called by its true name, human carbon nature. We must now act in opposition to the kind of creature that we have become. We must do something that no other species has ever done, to voluntarily place limits on its own impulses. If Jackson is right, then our diagnosis must look beyond traditional conceptions of sin and atonement to a new anthropology, that our very nature since the dawn of the Neolithic age is and always has been thoroughly entangled with growing, now massive, consumption of carbon energy. The organism that Christ is redeeming is one deeply entangled in the scramble for carbon. But for Christian theology, the Canadian theologian Douglas John Hall offers what I think is a more helpful, if more radical, critique. Hall looks to Martin Luther's framing of the struggle within Christianity between the theologies of glory on the one hand and the theology of the cross on the other. The theology of glory, Hall argues, is best understood using the shorthand triumphalism. And this skips over a whole lot, but let me go to this shorthand. Triumphalism, he says, refers to the tendency of all strongly held worldviews, whether religious or secular, to present themselves as full and complete accounts of reality, leaving little room, if any, for debate or difference of opinion, and expecting of their adherents unflinching belief and loyalty. For Hall, the dominant forms of Christian thought are fundamentally triumphalist, certain, final, in a single word, the truth. But if we picture only pushy fundamentalist caricatures of triumphalism, there is a banal triumphalism that lands much closer to home. It may include the exceptionalism behind the belief that all others may die while we live forever in paradise, or the assurance that our creeds should serve as the central test of legitimate faith, that our God is in complete control of every event in nature, that our truth will eventually be embraced by everybody else, or that God's incarnation and image reside in our species alone, and finally, that God will bring the universal history to its eschaton within the infinitesimal career, in geological terms, of human civilization. All of these suggest a tendency toward the triumphalism that characterizes the theologies of glory. Now, contemporary Christian responses to the ecological crisis often reflect such triumphalism. We are the chosen image bearers. We are a step removed from those outside our traditions. We're several steps removed from the non-human creation. God won't let the most terrible things happen. If God does, it won't happen to God's elect. And if that does, well, we've already gained our spot in a better world. This faith-born resistance to complete solidarity with the suffering world may explain why survey after survey demonstrates that Christians tend to care among the least about major ecological and social crises. And yet, if Hall is right, the Lord whom we profess to follow is incarnate in the very darkness of those crises and bids us to follow. And this brings us to the theology of the cross, what Hall calls a very thin tradition within Christianity. It argues that the suffering of the cross is not an event in the life of Christ, but rather it is in the very nature of the character of Christ, that God loves the creation by taking on its flesh, and that God in creation always is in solidarity with the weak, with the least, with the suffering, as we see in Christ on the cross. Christ suffers because he is with those who suffer, because the creation groans. And for the faithful, the cross is not something that was done once for us, but the timeless path of the one to whom we have sworn allegiance. It foregrounds, says Hall, something that's de-emphasized among common Christian priorities: God's nature as Emmanuel, God with us, God with us in inevitable suffering, God with us in our worst crises, God with all things in a creation that now must suffer, and God calling us into solidarity with an inevitably injured world. This is probably not the gospel that first attracted your attention. It certainly didn't attract mine in my youth when I became a Christian. But the chaotic world that we are entering now forces us to answer the question posed by Hall. Must we be the hucksters of expectations that are forever contradicted by experience? Or is it still possible for us to discern in our tradition the stuff out of which that sort of hope is made, which does not have to look away from death in order to find the courage to live? I believe this is the challenge now before us. For people of faith, I submit that this is the challenge of our time. And I'd be glad now to entertain your questions or comments on all of this.
Okay. Thanks to our speaker.
Thanks, John. Folks, I had a chance to talk to him yesterday a little bit ahead, so I had a little prelude to what was coming. So I want to ask you about Douglas John Hall, because I read him years ago and mostly didn't understand him. And so this is very helpful to see it, interpreted and applied, so that's helpful. But the key question to you is this. Something I didn't see in there, does he talk about fear? Because I think that's one of the drivers in this whole thing that's unspoken. And my sense of the few theologians in the Protestant and evangelical community I come out of, very few people talk about fear and make the connection. We're starting to talk about grief and grieving and being anxious and all of those things. But what's driving that, I think, is this existential fear that my sense is people have known for years that climate was changing, in denial. But the very first thing in denying death is to do what? I mean, is to deny death when it happens. So when crisis is coming, it feels like we're going to deny, and that's a fear response. And anyway, you want to comment on that?
Sure, John. To begin with, I would not say that I have seen in Hall a treatment of fear, as you say. But I would say that one might think that a descent into an abyss that is clearly visible, as you've suggested, ahead, would be led by people of a faith that you find, let's say, in Matthew chapter 8. The Son of Man must be rejected, right? The Son of Man must suffer. The Son of Man must be crucified, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and anyone who would follow him must do what? Take up their cross to be rejected, to suffer, and ultimately to join me in laying down my life, right? You would think, there's a faith that knows how to go into a fearful, fearsome situation. But instead, isn't it the case that we have become a tradition of very happy endings? Everything is guaranteed. You know, everything dies for us. All of nature is dying right now while we increase, right? Our own Savior died for us, right? Everything's going to be happy. And this sort of happy endings Christianity has become, I feel, unable to speak to a world where suffering can't be avoided. So I just offer that as your answer to fear.
Thank you, John. And I just give you another example of where I see this is in college administration, when higher ed is totally changing and when you fail to reach targets for enrollment, and it's like, well, God brings us the students that he wants to, right? So I've often wondered, is this an evangelical kind of Pollyanna? Is it American evangelical Pollyanna? Is this global wide? So what is there about the evangelical community that we experience that just uses religious language to cover up reality? Your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you, Janelle. I have my own thoughts on this, and I also have, let's call it Hallian thoughts on this, right? Don't get me wrong, I'm not a disciple of one particular theologian, but I thought he was very useful for this. And that is, Hall has called Christianity the officially optimistic religion of the officially optimistic society because of the power of the North Atlantic. Let's not just talk about America and Canada, but let's talk about the whole colonialist world, right? There was nothing that was not doable, right? Things tend to work together for good, for whatever it is, right? People like us. You know, remember when George W. Bush said, I have always found that things tend to work out for good. Helps to have your father as a vice president and an oil magnate, but things do work out for good, don't they? And this kind of optimistic, happy ending Christianity worked out, I think, as the palace religion of the American Empire or of the Northern European Empire. So whether it's evangelicals alone or not, that I can't really speak to.
I want to sneak in two questions. One is about, you didn't say anything about racial differences in the way people view the environment. And yet that is something that is very clear in all the polls. And so you've sort of said Christians, but the least privileged Christians have a different take on that. So that I wanted you to speak to that. But the second thing I wanted to ask is, you've in conversation talked about hopelessness, and yet the people that you recommend, I'm sorry, there is the quote here that says, "What is it possible to have the sort of hope?" So I want to know, are you suggesting moving to a different kind of hope? And what would that hope look like in actual action?
Well, I'll do my best, Dorothy, but time is tight, so I'll do it quickly. And let me just say, as to your first one, the Pew Survey and PRRI do break out religious groups, both in by race and also mainline and also Catholic and also Latino Catholic and so forth. Sometimes I think it's, yes, white evangelicals, I am sorry to say, come in the worst on all kinds of metrics this way. But the Christian community as a whole, even those that are the most responsive to the environment, tend also to be somewhat to this side of the spectrum in any event. So as to hope, it's axiomatic that hope and hopelessness are polar opposites. But in apocalyptic times, in times of the unveiling of the end of an age, which we are clearly in, if you don't like the words apocalypse, I am an apocalypticist. It's not because I'm saying that the end times are coming. It's because this age is clearly ending. Anyone who uses the term Anthropocene intentionally is saying the same thing, right? In apocalyptic times, the opposite of hopelessness is not hope. It is false hope. Well, where does that leave us? I'll put it this way. I have a love-hate relationship with the Moltmanns of the world, who are the prophets of hope, only because I believe in a hope that is only visible after hopelessness, after giving up on all of the things that hold us together. The best analogy I can give is of someone in Guatemala whose husband has been murdered by a gang, and who has been raped, and whose daughters are in threat of sex trafficking. And finally she said, "I give up. I'm hopeless. I'll go into the abyss. I'll pay a coyote to get me to someplace and I don't know where." She's hopeless, right? Go fast forward, and against all odds, she makes it to within sight of a refugee center. There is hope there, but only after first reaching hopelessness, only after giving up. And my challenge to white evangelical Christianity in North America, in the dominant North, would be, how do we first give up on this thing, this kingdom, to develop a new kind of a hope that's not wed to it? And now I'm sure I've gone over just in answering questions.
Thank you very much. So.